My name is Kelly Schwartz, and today we're going to be doing something a little bit different. Folks, we need to talk. I want you to do something for me. If you're somewhere safe to do so, I want you to close your eyes. Take a few deep breaths. Really enjoy the pause. Now, when you're centered, I want you to imagine a scientist. Just a generic off-the-shelf scientist. What do you see? My name is Kelly Schwartz, and I'm a postdoc in the Department of Biochemistry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm not sure I'd meet your expectations. My world, in many ways, can be parsed into objective reality and subjective reality. Oftentimes, my job requires me to mine the natural world for objective truth. Carefully gathered data is the currency of academia. We string data together to tell elaborate stories, what we call models or theories. We often lose ourselves as we explore the world, making observations, looking for hidden gems of objective truth. If you've ever spent time metal detecting, then you know what I mean. You get used to looking on the ground for change. It consumes you. We all bring expectations to every situation we encounter, every minute of every day. We thrive under routines where we know what to expect and we can peek into the future. When our expectations are not met, we may react with anger, fear, or confusion. It takes us less than a second for this reaction, this emotion, to come to the forefront of consciousness. This is what makes us human, snap judgments. Efficiency often disguised as personal agency. Before the brain has a chance to react, the parasympathetic nervous system has the body awash in protective chemicals to insulate the tender self. When an expectation meets an expert, a bargaining begins to take shape. No one likes to be told that they're wrong. Experts must tread softly. Some of this is leadership, some of this is earned respect, and some of this is the flair, panache, and hoodwink of the man behind the curtain. Well, who is the man behind the curtain? Are we disappointed to learn the true form of a great and powerful wizard is as small and frail as we? Would we still trust him if we were to shake hands, meet eye to eye, and discuss openly? If not, then why should we trust the experts? Upon returning to the U.S. after his ecstatic years in France, Henry Miller Riley stated that the most difficult adjustment an expatriate has to make on returning to his native land is in the realm of conversation. The impression one has, at first, is that there is no conversation. We do not talk. We bludgeon one another with facts and theories gleaned from cursory readings of newspapers, magazines, and digests. Talk is personal, and if of any value, must be creative. Surely, as scientists, we can do a better job opening up a line of communication. We can do more listening. We can share more than facts and theories. For these thoughts to even exist, I feel they must be actively pursued and explored and called into being. If you've ever spent time with engineers, you know that they are going to need scratch paper to draw out their thoughts for you. Similarly, scientists need to direct you to a series of data points. We are resilient, creative, resourceful, hardworking, proud, and dynamic people. We are also deeply insecure, anxious, overworked, and at odds with those who write our paychecks. We're just like everyone else, and just a little bit different. Science, as an institution, has many problems, and there are many reasons that taxpayers should be critical. But the struggles our community faces are nothing like what's been portrayed by the media. If we seem frustrated by your concerns about fluoride in the water system, it's because we hope to spare you a long and boring story, and we're doing some heavy calculations trying to clip that story into a bite-sized piece. Please, grace us with your patience. We truly want to do everything we can to help the world thrive. We know it takes a lot of work to understand the world, and that understanding starts with your own mind. I'll leave you with one last meditation. This time, if you don't mind too much, set a table for an academic and Henry Miller, who shares this moment with us. The earth is not a lair, neither is it a prison. The earth is a paradise, the only one we'll ever know. We'll realize that the moment we open our eyes, we don't have to make it a paradise. It is one. We have only to make ourselves fit to inhabit it. The man with the gun, the man with murder in his heart, cannot possibly recognize paradise, even when he's shown it. In this first episode, we explore feelings when our work grinds on us and how we cope with our time in academia. Joining me is my good friend, student of biochemistry, John, and a bottle of sake after hours in lab.
All right. What do you got? Shoot.
When do we stop having fun as research scientists?
when do things really, really catch up to you? It's a hard life, you know. It's a hard pace to maintain for an extended amount of time. I feel like we kind of approach academic research in kind of 4 to 5 year increments, where we're expected to just give it our all for about 4 or 5 years, and then give it our all for another 4 or 5 years, and then just give it our all. And at this point, you've invested 15 years of your life just giving it your all. And, you know, in your 20s, that's fine. You can. You do it. You do what you gotta do. It's real crazy when you look back what you've done to yourself, all in the name of just getting things done. But, you know, you can't sustain that forever. And I feel like by the time you get to the postdoctoral level, you're still expected to really work, you know, 20-hour days. And you just can't do that. Why? I mean, is that... So when does the work stop being fun? It's hard, but there's a lot of reward to it.
When does it stop being fun? My God. Well, that's loaded. When did it stop being fun for me? It's never not completely fun, you know? Like, it goes in spurts and waves, right?
What are you doing?
Unfortunately, you've lived through all of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
We've talked about this recently. I think it's once you've been doing it long enough, that you know, you reach a certain level of clarity about things. You're able to discriminate between what's really a waste of time and what isn't a waste of time. Yeah.
All right. So explain lizard brain to me again. What is the idea?
Lizard brain in science. So I just think that when you're kind of in survival mode, you really retreat into yourself and you really retreat into what you're doing, and you become just preoccupied and over-focused on what you're doing. And it really is just a kind of a survival response. This could be interpreted as anxiety. It could be interpreted as, you know, a number of different mental aspects that mean you're not taking care of yourself.
So what's a realistic cure for you?
A realistic cure for...
Not a Nintendo cure.
Yeah, that doesn't... For some people, it might be. You know, it's... It's just these little microaggressions that we have against us. It's everything. It's just that nothing about the built environment that we work in is made with us in mind. Like, very little of it is. Like, they build lab spaces where there's desks in the lab space and then tell you can't have a cup of coffee in the lab space. Now, what is the value in that? We have this really efficient lighting system that just makes you feel like you're in Joe versus the volcano.
Yeah.
There's just so many little aspects of life that are just so frustrating. Like you were saying, I feel so unhealthy.
It's very easy to forget all that stuff, yeah.
And if you feel unhealthy, like, how are you going to thrive?
Yeah.
If you yourself just don't feel good, for whatever reasons, and I think it's really easy to get beaten down and, like, backed into a corner by everything. So, you know, when you feel bad and gross, you're going to put that out into the world. And it's as important here as it is anywhere else. It's being able to separate yourself from the situation. But not ignoring it. It's being able to reflect on the situation in an objective way. And we're able to do this. You know, we have very good objective detectors. We're very good at pointing out problems to the point of driving ourselves and other people crazy. We can point out, you know, like the hidden aspects of life. But it's often the way
that you do it, though. I mean, it's whether it's in a destructive way or in a constructive way. You know, like you.
Because there's also a strong social aspect to that as well, and I'm not sure which one is the more curative. I think they both complement each other well, but scientists do have, for the record, very very well documented drinking aspects to them,
or some form of self-soothing.
Yeah, for sure.
Be it, you know,
it's just that we don't have a lot of time. You know, I feel like that's a really important thing. It's just, it's something that you have to be able to do at night.
Well, I think that gets back to the aspect of, like, what makes things fun, you know, like, what, where does the fun go? And yeah. It's really time.
Yeah, and if the only fun that you can have is after hours, that really limits what you can do, you know? If, especially living in Wisconsin, there's no sun.
Go for a walk. I have the luxury that I can stay however, work as late as I want. So.
Yes.
If you have a family, it can be the, you know, it can be a real pressure cooker, trying to get everything done before 5 or 6.
When are you most productive, do you feel? Are you still coming in early? Are you still...
I'm most productive outside of the hours of 9 and 5.
Sure. Sure.
The problem actually isn't ever the time. It's the schedule.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the fact that you have to hit a time. It's never the actual hour. It's the fact that you have to end at a certain hour. That's the real...
Yeah, right?
That's the real problem. Well, and that's the problem that people with families, you know, working really tough jobs. I mean, that's the part that I would really struggle with, you know. That gets back to my pet theory about what I think most people are doing wrong. And obviously this is, you know... I think it gets back to the idea of, like, people don't know the difference between science and academia, like, in general.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would say is, like, even if you're doing an experiment, even if you're, like, at the bench doing an experiment, but let's say you're just doing an experiment to get that perfect Western blot, you're doing that for academia. You're not doing that for science. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, you already know the answer.
But it's fun because you're doing a little trick.
But it's not the thing that you should take pride in.
No, that's also true. It's misplaced pride.
It's
yeah.
totally misplaced. Like, the thing you should take pride in is the intellectual property and the time that went all the whiteboarding, and that's the stuff. Should be fun, you know? Like, no, that's not what makes me happy. I mean, like, mastery makes you happy. And, okay, so the things that make me most happy are when you're, like, walking home. And you're kind of rehashing the day's events. And then you're just kind of talking to yourself in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
It takes me like a half an hour to walk home.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole time I'm kind of talking to myself, you know, in my mind. Actually, sometimes I'm talking out loud and it freaks people out. But when you, like, realize something through that conversation with yourself, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go in the next day and you try it out and it works, or, like, it turns out to be, like, or, you know, that's amazing. You know what I mean?
So do you feel like the hardest part of academic research is it getting the aha moments? Is it having those conversations with yourself? Is that more difficult than the academic aspects? Doing things day in, day out, writing papers, applying for grants. What do you think is more difficult?
It's a different kind of difficulty. So,
sure.
Like, I mean, obviously, I'm not a professor, so if you were to ask a professor, they'd have a completely different take on this. But
I can't get a professor to stay till 9 o'clock at night and drink sake with me, so sorry, dude.
I think it's a different kind of difficulty. So I think I'm willing to, like, pour my heart and soul into a problem that is, like, what I deem real, you know, like, real science, you know, like, would be, like, a real scientific question that I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm.
I have no problem, like, killing myself over that.
Mm-hmm.
What I have a real problem, like, killing myself over would be, like, writing a dissertation or something like that. You know, it's tragic, you know, like, there's a tragedy in... There's a sadness involved in the fact that you have to do stuff like that in order to survive. Okay, so I think a dissertation is a bad example. I think a better example would be a fellowship, writing a fellowship, or writing a grant.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we don't write a lot of grants, but doing something, basically when you're forced to write something that you really don't believe in, which is what everybody has to do.
Yeah.
that's the source of most people's sadness, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is the fact that we're not just allowed to do what we inherently love to do. We have to justify it with...
So do you see your research as, like, a form of play?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Like, yeah, absolutely. Otherwise, you know, like, why not just leave, get a job? I mean, I remember even before you had... Before there were image quants around, you know, it's like a Western blot. To get a single Western blot figured out, the problem is how much antibody do you add and what exposure do you use?
Right.
And this is with film, you know, and so that could take a week to figure out the exposure time, you know.
Did you ever use the exposure trick where you stack your film together?
Right.
So if you had a really hot blot.
Yeah, if you had a hot blot, you would.
Your second one might work out okay.
Yeah, exactly.
And you could at least show your PI that you tried.
But in order to get that perfect shot, you know, like, you gotta work for that.
Oh yeah, you don't get your publication quality figure on the first try. That's you still have to repeat it under the best possible circumstances a few times.
Yeah. I mean, you get a feel for your antibody. Yeah, it's all these there are so many parameters in any experiment.
Yeah, you get personal with your parameters.
That's something that doesn't translate well into manuscripts, into papers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Alright, but why is it fun?
Or why? Not? When is it fun? Yeah, when is science fun? I mean, it's fun, obviously, when things are working. It's fun when there's no conflict. It's fun when you feel...
Actually, it's not always fun when things are working.
No. Why?
because when you start to do stuff by rote, that's not interesting.
By rote meaning?
Meaning, like... Let's say your experiments are working, and all you have to do is, for the next month, you just have to come in and do the PCRs, and then you'll end up with the result that you want.
See, I kind of feel like that's good. Like, that's predictable.
Yeah.
You put a quarter in the machine, and a song plays.
Yeah, but it kind of kills the machine over time.
No, we're not the machine. Science is the machine. You put a quarter into nature and it sings you a song. You put a quarter into nature and it gives you a little toy.
I guess that's where we would differ a little bit.
Sure.
Which is, I don't know. I think...
Because it breaks eventually and then you have to figure out how to fix it.
I'm going to get into trouble saying this, but I think science is... I think it's so much more... It's more human... than anybody talks about, you know what I mean?
Like in what way?
Well, for instance, I mean, I was reading a poll recently about how many scientists believe in black holes.
believe. Not understand, but believe.
Yeah, and, like, I mean, I'm sure, like, on this, you know, my strategy for fighting lizard brain is I think, Bukowski. Well, I mean, one of his strategies that I heard about was whenever he's feeling depressed, he would just stay in bed for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then after 3 days, you're desperate to get out of bed. And that's kind of a good cure.
Oh, is it?
I don't know.
Yeah.
It seems to work sometimes.
You ever experimented with that before?
Unfortunately, yes.
I'll bet you now.
Mixed results.
Inconclusive.
Yeah. It's a short... There's a short term gain. Yeah. Yeah.
What percentage of scientists did believe in the Big Bang?
That's why I'm going to get into trouble. I don't remember the exact percentage, but it's not overwhelming. You know, it's not more than 50%.
It's not more than 50%.
Yeah.
Wow, that's crazy. I mean, how is the question worded? Because
we get into details. I don't know the answer to that.
Polling details, data collection method.
I think it was probably ambiguously worded.
Saki.
All right. We end this thing?
That before about science. Hello out there in Radio Land. This is Dennis Schaefer. What you just listened to was a new volunteer, Kelly Swartz, doing her first show. And Kelly's in the studio with me. And exactly, Kelly, what's your intent and what kind of shows you would like to produce for us?
Hi, thanks, Dennis. It's great to be here. So first I want to thank Evan Pope for that lovely musical interlude. Was kind enough to provide that for us. So my vision is getting the pop back on. So my vision in doing this show is, as a representative of science, I feel like there's a lot of conversation and there's a lot of experience that isn't necessarily told through interviews, or that is very difficult to actually get to. So with the thought that being an academic, it might be easier to get academics to open up about different topics and sort of come up with some interesting ways to approach this. So I'm interested in reaching out to the community a little bit, having some talks. If anybody has, you know, questions, we'll try to open up an avenue for that, maybe through quizzes, maybe through call-ins. We'll see kind of where that goes. I'm interested in doing some more kind of humorous and light work, maybe in answering Reddit questions for science.
I'm liking this.
Yeah. Ask science, because we can't swear in the air.
That was Kai Brito you just heard.
Yeah,
there.
That's true. Yeah,
he's in the studio with us also.
Yes, I think it would be. I think it'd be fun. I've got a ragtag group of friends that I think can produce some pretty cool content. So I'm very happy to be here, and thank you all for providing me this opportunity. Case is engineering tonight.
Whoop.
So.
Yeah, it also sounds like, so going back and listening to your interview, like when you were preparing for it, it sounds like, not that it wasn't prepared, but it does seem like there's points where, you know, the person that you were interviewing kind of like flipped the script on you. It's like, and it was asking you questions even, and you decided to include that. So like, you talk about like, you know, Dennis just asked you, what's your angle? So like, is that part of the way you plan to make it more conversational?
Absolutely. I think that instead of it being a one-way interview, I think that question and answer back and forth, that's how scientists talk to one another. You know, scientists kind of get a reputation for handing out truth, handing out this is the way it is. But when we talk to one another, there's so much ambiguity. There's so much conversation. There's so much, I don't want to say one-upmanship, but there's definitely a lot more back and forth and a lot more disagreement than one might see. And I want to be able to provide that for people as I get better and better at producing radio shows.
Well, one thing I was wondering about that I don't necessarily go into, because I like the people that I talk to at UW-Madison or wherever about what they do in their research.
Mm-hmm.
Is that sort of what your intent is also, as to maybe instead of talking about what they come up with, but how they do what they do and their opinions about how they go about their jobs?
Somewhat, yeah. I definitely think that I'm less focused on what their findings are and maybe more about the thought process behind it.
Okay.
And, you know, what we do to sustain ourselves and kind of our inner monologue and maybe... Yeah, I guess we'll see how the discussions go as time presses on. I have a kind of a framework that I'd like to work within, but I'm really excited to see how it turns out.
Do you have any other ideas for future shows?
I was just going to ask that. That's actually the million-dollar question. What's your next show?
I don't have any particular conversations lined up. I've got a list of ideas that I'd be happy to share with you guys, maybe off air. Hi, Heidi.
Hi. Sister Heidi in the house.
Sister Heidi in the house. Hey.
You're talking about your future show ideas.
Something we usually don't do on the air at PNM. Is it?
Oh, yeah. We're flipping the script all over the place. I think that I'm excited to see what conversations come up. All right. Well, okay. I hope everybody enjoyed the show, and thank you again for all of my fellow volunteers. It's great to have this opportunity.
Well, let me bring this up. We don't have much time left. If anybody out there that listened to Kelly's show tonight has any comments, go to our website, scienceonwart@gmail.com, and give us your opinions. What you think? Is it something that you would like to listen to in the future? You have any suggestions as to what Kelly can do maybe differently? And for other topics on things that we haven't really done in the past very, very often either. This is the Perpetual Motion Machine.